Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schlankofer. Civil Defense Radio is more than just a podcast about a new American civil defense structure. Through our total media presence, our website, Facebook, and Twitter pages, we work to inform you of the many serious threats, both natural and man-made, that our nation faces. Those issues many news outlets are afraid to speak about or unwilling to mention. We believe this total information approach will assist you in making the best possible decisions about the safety and security for yourself, your family, your neighborhood, and community during disastrous events. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and we want to be part of your preparation. That's why we strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. We offer guidance on our website at civildefenseradio.com under the Resources tab. Look for the guide at the top of the page. It is enough information to get the discussion started. And also, we are always here to help. We ask that you regularly download and listen to our shows and visit our web and social media platforms often at civildefenseradio.com, on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio, and on Twitter at civil_def_radio. Now, let's get on with our show. This week, we have the pleasure of having Tommy Waller on board. He's the Vice President of Special Projects with Center for Security Policy. How you doing, Tommy?
Hey, Preston. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure of ours having you here because Lord knows we've been trying to get you here for a while.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. It's been pretty busy for sure.
First off, just full disclosure, I like to do this. I've known you for a while now because we're associated together in a group that you head up, and we'll talk about that here in a little bit. But can you go ahead and give our friends that are listening an idea of who you are and where you come from?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So right now, as you mentioned, I'm the Vice President for Special Projects at the Center for Security Policy. We'll definitely talk a little bit more about the Center for Security Policy shortly, but you know, prior to having this position as a civilian occupation, I served a number of years on active duty in the Marines. Growing up, that's really all I ever wanted to do was to serve in the military, and then specifically the Marine Corps, and was blessed to be able to do so. Really, for about a decade on active duty, until I really just felt the calling to leave active duty. And, Preston, quite honestly, I didn't know what it was for. My wife and I took a leap of faith and we left active duty. I kind of bounced around between jobs and, reserve deployments until I found, or the job that I'm in now found me. And so throughout that service, in the Marine Corps, I consider it, a blessing to have been provided a lot of, real world experience that I hope to be able to bring to the table when it comes to helping make policy decisions and encouraging people to be prudent and prepared just the same way that you do based on your military experience. During that period of time on active duty, I am an infantry officer and conducted combat operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. Those deployments, there were three deployments I did on active duty, and then one in the reserves with 3rd Force Reconnaissance Company in Africa. And so kind of all that background is relevant in the sense that, as we will discuss shortly, a lot of what we're going to talk about today I was not aware of it on active duty. And so it just underscores the importance of the work of the Center for Security Policy. Now I'm in a position where I'm doing the best I can to make sure that those who serve and those who are citizens of our country are afforded the really critical types of information that I wasn't at the time.
No, that's good. And thank you for your service. It's very commendable what you've been doing and your service with the Center for Security Policy. There's so much great work being done there. I wish I had the ability to post it on billboards on Times Square, but that takes a lot of money. So, and influence, but, you guys are doing great work. And, can you give us a better idea of what, CSP is doing and who runs that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it goes back to the Center for Security Policy's founder, Frank Gaffney. So Frank has a very long career in the national security space, but at the age of 33, he was serving in the Reagan administration, was nominated by President Reagan to become the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy. And so that was a senior position in the DOD, responsible for the policies that involved the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, nuclear forces, arms control, missile defense, a lot of really, really critical components of our national security in relation to what at the time was the most profound threat to the Republic, the USSR. And so that was what Frank did at the age of 33. After the Reagan administration, what Frank really kind of came to the conclusion of is when he was working in the White House, we worked in previous roles as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Nuclear Forces and Arms Control Policy. He worked as a professional staff member on the Senate Armed Services Committee. All that work that he did for politicians that were from both sides of the aisle, Democrat, Republican, he never really had a one-stop shop, one place, one resource that he could go for really timely, pertinent national security-related information to help these policymakers make decisions. And so after the Reagan administration, Frank established this nonprofit, the Center for Security Policy, which as of last year has now been in existence for 30 years, for three decades. And so, a couple of important factors about the center that Frank established from the get-go was that the organization as a nonprofit, 501c3, it doesn't take any money from the government. Now, there are other nonprofits that do, but our nonprofit doesn't. We don't take money from the government at the federal level, state, or local level. And what that does, it allows us to be completely unconstrained in our analysis of threats. We don't have to worry about a lot of think tanks will take government contracts, and then they'll sort of turn around and just kind of tell the government what the government wants to hear. And that's not the Center for Security Policy. So as a nonprofit, we beg for a living. We have to try to find people who care about this issue of national security. But it keeps us pure. It keeps us in a situation where there's nobody who can pull the strings on what it is that we analyze. And I think that's important, particularly in today's threat environment where so many threats, people are ridiculed by speaking the truth about those threats.
Well, there's too much political correctness that has interjected itself into the analysis process. And unfortunately, many Americans are being lied to and deceived in ways that are actually dangerous and detrimental to the safety and security and future of our nation.
Absolutely. No, you're absolutely right. And that political correctness, if you want to call it that, or the abuse of language,
that too.
It worked its way in, but it was purposeful. I mean, particularly the first portfolio that Frank asked me to work on was in relation to, and I still work on this portfolio, in relation to the global jihad movement, right? So the overarching doctrine of Sharia, or divine Islamic law, that requires the jihad that we see throughout the world, what most people call terrorism. One of the most ominous components of that jihad is civilization jihad, or as some people have called it, stealth jihad, which the Muslim Brotherhood is executing globally, but very profoundly and effectively here in America. And so that's really what I started at the Center for Security Policy to dive into. And there again, it was a topic that, although I had done multiple combat deployments overseas to areas where we were fighting jihadis who were fighting us because of what the Sharia requires,
right?
And they were fighting us so they could establish the Sharia. That effort was one that I undertook without any knowledge of what motivated those enemy combatants. And so that was the first thing that I began to work on at the Center for Security Policy. Until Frank gave me some new marching orders in the summer of 2014.
Many of us in the warrior field, law enforcement and military, a lot of times, we get an order, we say, aye, sir, 10 bags full, and we drive on. We don't really think about the backstory, like you were saying. You never really considered what motivated these people that we were going up against, the ones that caused 9/11 and all this. So it's important to understand your enemy. And Sun Tzu said something like, know the enemy, know yourself, or something like that. And
right.
So it's imperative to know the philosophy and even the traditions of somebody that you're going against. So it just makes sense to do that.
Right. Right. Or someone who's going against you, right, and going against your nation, your family. We look at jihadis, it's absolutely brutal what they do to humanity. And so you're right. It's so important to understand them. And so, yeah, fortunately, the Center for Security Policy, again, unconstrained in our analysis, we've been able to study and publish probably nearly 50 monographs on the different components of Sharia and the global jihad, civilization jihad. And so, you know, for your listeners that are interested in that work, I would, you know, commend them to go to centerforsecuritypolicy.org and take a close look at it. But the reality, Preston, I think, as you are aware, which is why you are on a daily and weekly basis doing such great work on the civil defense front, the reality is that the global jihad, if we don't defend ourselves, it will overtake us like it has so many other civilizations. I believe 7 civilizations so far, at the expense of about 270 million human lives over 1,400 years. But it takes time for that to occur. And so, you know, there are other ways that our civilization can be overtaken in a much faster method. And those are the things that in the summer of 2014 that Frank Gaffney, you know, sat down to share with me, which is really what precipitated now the relationship you and I have on another front.
I never knew about Frank Gaffney until I got into intelligence. And actually, when I moved to D.C. and began working at the headquarters level of ICE in our intelligence operation there, you know, doing I was in charge of a bunch of analysts and learning about analytical products and methods and stuff like that. And Frank's name was mentioned a lot in those early days of my extended education at headquarters. So I grew a great appreciation for him and his reputation before I even met him, which I finally did at some conference in Maryland at the University of Maryland University College. There was an event there for a couple of days that he was a speaker at. And so it was a pleasure meeting him after learning about his reputation.
Well, Preston, it's encouraging to hear that it was a positive reputation in government at the time that you were there. You know, there has been a significant concerted and effective effort among the political elites that would want the status quo, or that really have been apologists for the Muslim Brotherhood, for them to defame my boss and the organization for which I work. So it's very encouraging to hear that guys like you could see through those false you know, accusations and really kind of get an appreciation for the work that Frank was doing and the type of man that he is. I mean, he's genuinely just a very good man, humble. You know, we, as I mentioned before, as a nonprofit, you know, we very rarely take the credit for a lot of the stuff that we get done. And that's because of Frank's humility and his proclivity to follow Ronald Reagan's example as well, you know, to worry about accomplishing the mission and not who gets credit for it. And so it's an absolute honor for me to be able to get to work for and with him.
Yeah, I can imagine. So you and I are actually associated in a project that you lead for the Center for Security Policy. Can you tell us a little bit about the Secure the Grid Coalition?
Sure. Yeah. Well, Preston, you know, it goes back to that summertime 2014. I had been working the Global Jihad portfolio for some time, and Frank asked me to come out to his home in Virginia and sit down with him to, you know, for an important discussion. And you know, we sat down and he went through and began to inform me about the vulnerability of the U.S. electric grid, about the phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse and the many other hazards besides electromagnetic pulse that could critically harm our electric grid, and the overwhelming dependency for our nation, both, you know, from a national security and military perspective, but also just for the support of American citizens and their survival He began to lay out all of that for me with the request that I would add this important portfolio to the work that I was doing at the center. Of course, I immediately dove into a study of everything I could get my hands on in relation to the topic of electromagnetic pulse and other threat vectors to the electric grid, and quickly came to the conclusion that what Frank was asking me to do was immensely important. And so the quick history there is that, you know, Frank and others in the Pentagon and elsewhere, had been aware of electromagnetic pulse for a long time. Of course, you know, we all now know that the phenomenon was discovered, source region EMP was discovered in our surface nuclear tests in the 50s, where we started to figure out that, you know, wires that touched the fireball of a nuclear blast were highly electrified. There was this thought that perhaps if it was launched and detonated in the exo-atmosphere, that there would be electromagnetic effects as well. And again, as maybe some of your listeners are aware, the U.S. government and the USSR both did high-altitude nuclear tests and discovered this phenomenon of EMP, which was highly classified. And so Frank was one of the guys that knew about that, you know, but he couldn't talk about it for so many, many years.
Right.
And so when the Congressional EMP Commission published its first report in 2004, unfortunately, the same day as the 9/11 Commission report came out, that was the first, you know, sort of permissive environment to begin speaking about it. Many of the national security experts like Frank and others, Dr. Peter Pry, people who were associated with the Congressional EMP Commission or just who were passionate about protecting against EMP, thought for sure that once the 2008 report, the second report from the commission came out, that the government and the industry would do the right thing and protect their assets. And by 2010, it became clear that that was not the case. And that's when they formed what at the time was called the EMP Coalition. And that EMP Coalition was co-chaired by Newt Gingrich, a former House Speaker, and Ambassador R. James Woolsey, the former Director of Central Intelligence. And so that the EMP Coalition became, over a few years, renamed to the Secure the Grid Coalition, because it was a recognition that there needed to be an all-hazards focus on protecting the grid, not just from EMP. And so that's exactly what Frank asked me to administer. And one of the things that I do now for the Center for Security Policy is to maintain and administer that Secure the Grid Coalition.
Yes, and you do a great job of hosting that call and keeping all the cats herded in the same direction.
I'm trying. It's a lot of smart cats.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take a quick break for commercial, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, please allow me to speak with you about something you may want to add to your regular health maintenance routine, as well as your preparedness supplies. A few years ago, I came across an article in a preparedness magazine that caught my attention. My wife and I have always been health conscious, and we have taken various supplements over the years. However, this article introduced us to the world of essential oils. My wife began researching to find a reputable company with high-quality products. What she found was a company that we have been with now for about 4 years, using their products, many of them daily. The company is doTERRA, and their products are certified pure, therapeutic-grade essential oils. Essential oils come in all grades on the scale, but doTERRA oils are, in our opinion, at the top. Sure, you can go to Walmart or your local pharmacy and purchase essential oils, but not many of them are recommended for internal use. Many of our oils can be used orally, topically, and diffused for their wonderful aromatic fragrance and health benefits. Some of our favorites we use almost daily are lemon, clove, frankincense, lavender, Angar blend, peppermint, and melaleuca, also known as tea tree oil. These oils have become our go-to remedies for managing our health throughout the year. In fact, we credit our oils for our overall good health. You can too. Just visit our website at www.oilsforlifetoday. That's oils4lifetoday.com and explore the wonderful world of certified pure, therapeutic grade essential oils for yourself. And we're back with Tommy Waller, Vice President Special Projects at Center for Security Policy.
Good. Yeah. Hey, I'm a big believer in essential oils as well, Preston. So we use them here at the house. So glad to hear that you're like-minded in more than one way.
Yeah, we've got a lot of things in common, buddy. it was a great pleasure to be invited into the group at the Secure the Grid Coalition by our mutual friend Michael Mabee, and I look forward every week to listening in on what's going on, and you know, given the opportunity to update the group on what we're doing here in Virginia as well, and what we're doing with civil defense. So can you give us an idea of some of the things that the Secure the Grid does? And you know, you might mention its website as well if you can.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, well, you know, what I should do is really kind of start with the first year of as I began to work this issue of looking at the threats to the grid, and we looked at the sort of policy making environment at the time, and the fact that 2015 was a lead up to a presidential election. You know, the Center for Security Policy sponsored a number of nonpartisan, nonpolitical national security action summits. In these summits, we invited candidates from both sides of the aisle, anybody who would want to be briefed on important topics and then have the opportunity to speak about those important topics. And the four topics that we covered at these National Security Action Summits were the hollowing out of the U.S. military, immigration insecurity, the global jihad movement and Sharia, and the vulnerability of the U.S. electric grid. Well, it turned out that May 2015, we were in the state of Iowa, and we were visited by a number of candidates. Dr. Ben Carson was among them at the time, businessman Donald Trump. And so we actually got, you know, about 35 to 40 minutes of FaceTime with Mr. Trump at the time, and sat down and with members of our coalition, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, foremost among them, sat down and briefed then candidate Donald Trump on the phenomenon of EMP and what an incredible danger it was to our nation. And he made a commitment right there that if, you know, I think he said when I'm president, you know, that he would get after, you know, having the government, I can't remember the exact words he said, but to solve that problem. And so, you know, perhaps one of the most incredible achievements of the Secure the Grid Coalition is not just from that initial briefing or interaction, but through, you know, numerous interactions over a number of years, members of our coalition, senior leaders, have been able to really transform the executive branch's appreciation for the phenomenon of EMP and what it could do to our critical infrastructure. And that's what resulted really in executive order that the president issued on March 26th of this year to protect our critical national infrastructure, make it resilient to both natural and man-made electromagnetic pulse.
Yeah, and there's action steps that various agencies and departments have to perform, correct?
There is. Yeah, in fact, the executive order was really well done. It included a lot of the suggestions and recommendations from people in government and outside of government who have been trying for years to get this topic addressed by the executive branch. To the credit of the Obama administration, they did have a space weather strategy and a space weather action plan. So the good thing is many of the folks that worked on that from the Space Weather Prediction Center and other places in government were part of the drafting process of the current executive order on EMP. So it was able to take good work from the previous administration and add to it this new focus on man-made EMP, nuclear high-altitude EMP, in such a way that it filled in a lot of gaps in the policy world. Now, that executive order is only as good as the people who are going to execute it. And their passion for actually achieving what the president wants done. And it's also only as good as Congress will appropriate the funds to be able to take care of the different aspects of the executive order that require funding. So while it's a monumental step in the right direction, it's not a be-all, end-all, and it's going to require continued shepherding, you know, throughout the process of the timelines and deadlines that have been established in the executive order.
Yes, but we in the Secure the Grid Coalition, we are watching that daily for various steps to happen and be reported on. They probably didn't know it when they were ordered by the executive order to do certain things, but these department heads, they have quite a few people that are watching them on a regular basis.
Absolutely. You know, Preston, I think you realize this, but maybe for your listeners to understand, you know, one of the real values of the Secure the Grid Coalition is that we're kind of the watchdogs, you know, and you know, there are other nonprofits out there that focus on grid security. There's not a whole lot of them that are willing to, you know, speak truth to power in such a way that might risk, you know, ruffling feathers. And so as kind of the watchdog of the industry and of government, I think that the coalition does a great service to make sure that, that the folks who should be doing the right thing know that there are people who are paying close attention to make sure they do.
Yes, yes, and that's very fortunate. You know, with all the activities dedicated towards trying to get government, and the coalition is working not only at the federal level, but at state and locals as well. And, you know, our friend Michael Mabey says all roads lead to civil defense, which means, in a sense, that you got to be ready in your home, your neighborhood, your community for any type of event to happen, especially these ones that we're looking at. And if you are, then you're going to be doing pretty well. But if you don't have a civil defense organization or something that maybe another name than civil defense, but does the same thing by building true resiliency within the families and neighborhoods in the community, then you may be hurting if something should happen. You know, we've got a lot of enemies out there and they're just waiting to cut the string. You know, we've got a lot of cyber activity that's going on right now. That's troubling, I think.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, in so many ways, our adversaries are encroaching on our nation's security. And it's just that the one way that for the first time in human history, that it won't take a whole nother civilization rising to an equal or greater power to take down another, and in this case, the most sophisticated electronic civilization in the world, it doesn't take a whole other civilization. It just takes one adversary, perhaps even a non-state actor, with one nuclear weapon detonated at the right altitude above our nation. And so that's just what makes this so critical that we protect those assets from it. You know, cyber attacks, a sophisticated cyber adversary, again, doesn't take a huge, gigantic level of national power if that if there is a vulnerability there and it can be exploited by someone with the knowledge and the intent to do so. Our coalition's interested in protecting the most critical of our national infrastructures, the electric grid, upon which everything else depends from all those threats. And Preston, I do agree. It all boils down to, you know, at the end of the day, it's not if, it's a when. I mean, we keep having security professionals tell us that for the last decade. It's not if, but when we see, say, for example, a quote, cyber 9/11. Janet Napolitano told us that. So for your listeners, I'm encouraged that that there are a lot of people out there who are looking to be prudent and prepared for this sort of thing at the family and community level.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe you can back me up on this. It doesn't take an ICBM coming in to our atmosphere and to take us out. There are actors out there who are willing to give their lives to get as close to our shore as they can and release a scud or something from a freighter. That stuff's been practiced. You know, it works. So the Iranians are, you know, they've done it. The North Koreans have done it. And our adversaries have in their strategic plans to hit us with cyber and EMP, whether it's a electromagnetic pulse from a high altitude nuclear burst or some other energy powered weapon. But their strategy is to take us out so that they can knock out command and control.
Right, exactly. You know, electromagnetic pulse is actually part of the cyber warfare doctrine of our adversaries. They put the two together. And so unfortunately we separate the two, and there's been a huge emphasis on cyber and not so much on electromagnetic pulse, but they consider both of them part of the same warfighting doctrine. And exactly, I mean, there's no sense in an adversary attacking us at our strengths. This is the weakness that we have and that we must really figure out a way to defend against. And part of that defense is, you know, the idea that the American people would be able to survive such an attack. And the only way that would be the case is if people become more resilient and we do bring back the concept of civil defense.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That's my mission. You know, our friends out there listening to us right now, if you can, if you know somebody at your local city or county or even state level that has any power, any political position or anybody who have influence, talk to them about the power grid, because that is our Achilles heel. That is where we will be hit. Seems like there's forces within our country that are trying to keep us from making that more secure. And Michael Mabee did a great expose on that, and you can go back and listen to the interview I did with Michael. It was under the China influencing our grid security. So that'll be in the show notes as well. We've got a lot of threats, and people are not being made aware. That's part of the my mantra is be safe, be informed, be prepared. Being informed is understanding these threats that we face, and they are real.
Yeah, absolutely, Preston. And unfortunately, not only are the threats real, but you know, the swamp is deep for those folks that are inside of our own country that want to deny those threats. Or in some cases, as Michael maybe probably mentioned on his show previously, you know, there are adversaries in a position to lobby our institutions to be more vulnerable, and it's in their interest to do so.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, you know, for your listeners to know that we have this coalition that is active if they want to participate, you know, and they can get on the email list for the weekly roll-ups that we do. You know very well, Preston, how, you know, on a routine basis, when we discover that there's an issue that needs some attention or some influence, how we are able to mobilize a coalition to take action for that purpose. And so, for example, Michael maybe probably talked a little bit about the process by which FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, oversees the electric power industry and the rulemaking process, and how our coalition has been successful in influencing those rules to be made in a more responsible fashion in relation to grid security, particularly cybersecurity. Well, similarly, when it comes to things that, for example, the president's executive order, one of the things that he tasked the Department of Interior to do is a geomagnetism survey throughout North America so that we could understand how the ground in North America will react to natural or man-made EMP, which will help us protect against it. And so what you have is a situation right now that if Congress does not appropriate the funds to keep the USGS program that does this work going, then the program will stop in a lot of areas. There's at least three Air Force bases that will put in mothballs the GIC, the ground-induced current monitors at those Air Force bases. So that's an example. This Friday, we're going to have an expert talk about that, and our coalition is going to figure out what we need to do to influence Congress to do the right thing.
Well, I mean, this stuff is stupid simple. Why would anybody resist on something like this? Except it's because of who sits in the big chair in the White House. It's politics over the safety and security of our nation and her people. And that is unconscionable. You know, I like to stay apolitical on this show, but I don't care if somebody has a D or an R next to their name and they're supporting the rights and security of Americans and our nation, I'm going to be behind them. But if they're working against us, then I'm going to be against them, and I'm going to be against them hard. So it's unconscionable. It really is. It infuriates me.
Well, we like to take our passion for this and have the outlet be solid influence and policy recommendations. And, you know, one of the things that I'm sure your listeners grapple with as well, and as do I know you and I, and that is the kind of notion that this whole topic really makes you want to run for the frontier. You know, you think about the prospect of a prolonged outage, you know, and you kind of think about like, okay, I got to run to the frontier. I got to get to my grid down retreat site, you know. But Dr. Peter Pry once mentioned something I thought was pretty profound, and that was that the founders of the country had an infinite frontier to run to when they founded this nation. And so rather than moving west into that infinite frontier to escape the tyranny that they faced under the British Empire, they turned and they fought that tyranny. And so as much as we should be preparing ourselves and being prudent at a personal, family, community level, we also need to turn and fight this tyranny of inaction and get involved in the process of influencing the powers that be in government and in industry to do the right thing to protect these assets.
You know, I don't think we could have had a more apropos ending than what you just spoke. Tommy, that was I hadn't heard that quote, but man, that is powerful. And I hope my friends out there will remember that. I've read a lot of his writings, but I haven't read that. That's very profound.
And it was just a conversation, you know, it was a conversation with him when we talked about this topic that came up, but it just stuck with me. You know, I think it's true. So if your listeners want to get involved, you know, I'm sure you'll have it in the notes, but securethegrid.com is the website. And of course, if they hit the request for information there and subscribe, or get in touch with you, we can loop them into what they need to know to get on our teleconferences. And be put on the email list.
Great. Well, Tommy, it's been a pleasure. The top-down governmental approach to solve our community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem of resiliency. We are looking for volunteers throughout the nation to pick up the mantle of civil defense for their communities. Let's start a conversation with a guide found on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. I wish to thank our guest, Tommy Waller, again, and thanking you, our listeners, our friends out there. I really appreciate you listening to the show this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you and keep you until next time.